in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ, with this Rain Report. August 15, 2003 will be remembered by many as a sad day in the annals of ham radio. That was the day Roy Neal, K6DUE, succumbed to complications following heart surgery. He was 82. Roy was former NBC television science reporter. He played a pivotal role in launching and keeping ham radio in space. Many of you will recognize his voice from his decades of reading for the Amateur Radio Newsline. For the next 2 weeks, we shall honor the memory of this class act by bringing you an interview with Roy, conducted in the fall of 2000 by RAIN founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP.
Thank you very much for your time today, first of all.
Pleasure to be with you, Hap.
Let's go back to your boyhood. Since you were so involved later on with being a reporter and covering space and early aviation, did you dream about this as a boy?
I kind of migrated into it, Hap. When I was a boy, well, let's begin sort of age 12 or 13 when I was a Boy Scout. At that time, I was interested tremendously in ham radio and became a ham radio operator. That, by the way, on a timetable would put you back into the 30s. I was first licensed in 1934 as W3GIB in suburban Philadelphia. Now, at about that same time, I hadn't the slightest idea where I was going to wind up as far as a profession was concerned. I looked seriously at the law. I looked seriously at acting, mainly because I enjoyed getting out in front of the public. One thing led to another, and in time, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. There, I took a serious interest in acting and in writing, and again, one thing led to another, and I wound up, of all things, starting on a small radio station out in suburban Philadelphia, which became a very large radio station. That, in turn, led to service in World War II as a GI. And once the war was over and I could get out of the fighting troops and get back into broadcasting, I did it in Europe, where I rapidly rose to become program manager of Armed Forces Radio in Europe. Then back to the United States. And frankly, radio was pretty dull by that time. I was looking for something new. I had had all the heady experience of running a network, and independent radio no longer was fascinating. But there was something new. It was television. I saw television at a very early age and began in the business physically in 1947 in spring. At that time, by the way, in Philadelphia, there were 132 television sets, Hap. And we knew how many there were because to find out what we'd have on the air, literally you had to send us a postcard requesting the service, and then we would send you back the program schedule, and on the back of the schedule we had an automatic rating service, probably the only accurate rating service television has ever known, because to get the next program you had to send back the rating, and that in turn prompted our next postcard to you. The rise of television was rapid, of course, and by 1952 there were over 1 million sets in the Philadelphia area, and at that time we were about to pick up on our first transcontinental cable, which wasn't really a cable, it was microwave. At that time, of course, we didn't have satellites, but we did have a microwave in the offing, and the telephone company put it together in 1952. And NBC picked me up. I had been working at an NBC affiliate and doing a lot of broadcasting for the network. So they picked me up and let me go west to become head of the news department for the western states and Hawaii and Alaska. Oh boy, what an assignment. By this time, of course, I was up to my ears also in ham radio, and I became K6DUE, giving up my W3 call. By the way, that's a traumatic experience if there ever is one. But I went on, and once in California, then I had always had a fascination with aviation. Edwards Air Force Base was in the backyard of of Los Angeles, and Edwards Air Force Base was where all the super speedy aircraft, all the new things were being tested. So I went out there and soon got to know people like Chuck Yeager, first man to fly supersonic, and others, lots of others, including the X-15 pilots, all of them. That, in turn, with the rocketry of the X-15, led to a connection with the Air Force, which was about to start building rockets and missiles. That would have been 1957. By 1957, by this time, I was a pretty well-known expert in the field of aviation. and the military was just beginning on a very secret program. I'll tell you how secret it was. The officers in the Air Force wore civilian clothes. Their headquarters was what had been a parochial school near what is now the Los Angeles Airport. Out there, they designed and built the Thor missile, the Atlas missile, the Minuteman missile. And they allowed me to share their secrets on a need-to-know basis so that when the time came to fly, I could go to the Cape, Canaveral that is, and start covering these darn things, knowing they'd be too big to hide. And so I went to the Cape back in 57 and started covering from there, still living in Los Angeles, still oriented to the West Coast, and still covering all kinds of news. I pioneered a good many of the television techniques that are in service today because videotape came along. And by the time videotape in 59, 60, 61, during that era, once videotape began to become more sophisticated, so too were our production techniques. And at that time, I was fortunate to be able to cover people like John Glenn on their first flight, Alan Shepard, etc., and the rocketry became paramount among the things that I covered for NBC. Pioneering videotape, covering space, and generally being a general coverage correspondent for the network became, of course, more than a full-time occupation. But I enjoyed it and had a great time. And that, in 1,000 words or more, Hap, is a fast answer to how I got to what I did until 1986, when finally the network let me retire in peace and get back to the serious business of putting ham radio onto space stations and space shuttles.
And, of course, we'll get to that a little bit later. Let's backtrack to when you were program director for Armed Forces Radio in Europe during World War II. Did Armed Forces Radio really make a difference? Did it really fill a need?
Oh, a tremendous need. Armed Forces Radio is given credit for having been one of the great morale factors of all time. I can give you a case in point. Shortly after the war, most of the troops were restive. Most of them, like me, were handcuffed volunteers. They were there because they had to be there to serve their country, but they really wanted to get out and go home. And they could see no real reason why they couldn't go home right away. Well, of course, the Army can't move everybody immediately, especially when you're numbering up in the hundreds of thousands. At that time, Eisenhower had just left the theater. His replacement was a general named McNarney. And believe it or not, Hap, McNarney was faced with the possibility that the United States Army might go on strike because the troops in the field were getting so restive they were ready to strike to go home. One of their favorite songs was to the tune of Livy Marlane, and it was, "Please, Mr. Truman, when can we go home?" And McNarney, the general, turned to Stars and Stripes, the newspaper, and to us, Armed Forces Radio, and said, "Fellas, you're supposed to be experts. How do I handle this situation? We dreamed up a radio show, a show that had the enlisted men in the field talking to the top general officers at their headquarters. We brought them in, literally allowed them to do the interviews, and the general officers stood still for those interviews on the basis that the questions asked would be known in advance."
How often did the show air?
Once a week. And believe it or not, the threat of a strike went away because it resolved the problems. You told the troops what they wanted to know.
I'm speaking today with Roy Neal, KCUE, former science editor of NBC Television, producer, reporter, and of course a familiar voice on Amateur Radio Newsline. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
We had Glenn Miller as our house band, which is not a bad house band, I think you'll agree. And at that time, Johnny Desmond was the vocalist. Johnny used to sing in three or four languages, German among them, French among them, Italian among them. Of course, Johnny D was Italian by nature. But he had a huge audience, so big in the foreign countries that when we wanted to close down our station in Paris, the French had a vote, and by 70%, decided they liked American radio, a foreign language, rather than their own Radio Diffusion Française. The impact of radio was tremendous. It was a morale factor, no question. And we were given pretty much carte blanche to do what we wanted by the general officers in the theater, including Eisenhower. Matter of fact, I remember Eisenhower vividly because I went to him and said, "I think, General, you ought to give your troops what amounts to a fireside chat, like the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt." Well, Eisenhower looked at me and he said, no, I don't think I have that much to say, but because you've come up with this idea, I will have an announcement, and I'll make it to the world through Armed Forces Radio in a couple of weeks. That was when he gave his farewell to his troops in Europe, Ab. And that's how you get a scoop, by going to the top officer in the theater and showing a little aggressive presence, looking for things that he might do that might solve problems for the troops.
With all of the time you spent around the aviation industry, and of course later NASA, did you ever have the desire to become a pilot?
I always wanted to be, and in all honesty, I just didn't have the time to take the lessons and study the field. I was too darn busy running around covering news. And so that's why I never became a pilot. I always wanted to, and when the time came that there was a possibility that civilians might be able to fly in spacecraft, I even put in an application. And because I had married a girl who had been a worker for NASA, I was eliminated early on in the contest. They refused to allow anybody who had any connection with NASA in any form to be a contender for that post. And then, of course, there was a horrible tragedy which knocked off all possibility of news people or others going up into space.
The terrible tragedy you referred to was the Challenger?
Absolutely. By that time, I was primarily working as a producer rather than on the air. It was near my closing days with NBC, and they had me in charge of the radio network for the West Coast and producing a great deal of television. On the day that it happened, I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. NASA had two stellar attractions on that day. They had another bird, a probe, out in deep space. We were going to send back first pictures of, I believe it was Uranus, a distant satellite, which would play opposite the crew that was being launched on the day. So as I was in the parking lot, suddenly the thing blew. And here I was with a live camera and crew. Nothing would do but they put me on the air. And the question was one of, did the crew survive? And I immediately said there was no chance. First of all, they had been hit by the force of a detonation equal in size to a small atom bomb. And secondly, they had then had a descent at a tremendously accelerated rate of speed into the ocean, and there was no way that they could have survived any of this. Tom Brokaw picked up on that fact that it had the detonative power, the explosive power of a small atom bomb. So they had me on the air. After that, remember, I was working as a producer as well as a reporter by that time. They put me as a number two or three guy in charge of investigating what had happened, how it had happened, and what NASA could do about it to get back into space.
That must have been one of the most difficult moments in your reporting career, I would imagine.
Not really. You see, it was difficult from the standpoint that we didn't really know what had happened. On the other hand, we certainly had knowledge, because we could see it, that a terrible tragedy had taken place. But if you're a reporter, those things don't faze you quite as much. You're used to going out to things like plane wrecks and train wrecks and walking through bodies, Hap. You have to put on a hard shell of armor so that your feelings can't be allowed to interfere with reporting the story. When the Hindenburg burned and a reporter simply fell apart in tears to a point where he could no longer report, he became famous through all of this. But in my book, he was infamous. He didn't report the story. He cried his way out of it.
Roy Neal, KCDUE, science editor for NBC Television, from 1952 to 1986, and a familiar voice to listeners of the Amateur Radio Newsline. Next time, Roy will talk about ham radio's introduction and reintroduction to the NASA space program and to the International Space Station. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago.
Hap will return with part two of his interview with the late Roy Neal, K6DUE, next time. Just a reminder that if you didn't catch the article about Hap that was published by a Chicago area newspaper last week, you'll find it off the opening screen of rainreport.com on a link labeled About Hap. The Rain Report is copyright 2003 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ.